Sloppy Spoilers with your host, DT2. Hello and welcome to another episode of Sloppy Spoilers. I'm your host, DT2 Comics Chat. You can find me on Twitter at DT2 Comics Chat. We're going to be discussing Season 2, Episode 4 of The Boys and Umbrella Academy. I'd like to welcome my co-host. Welcome to David Nemesis Howard. And where can we find you on Twitter?
Hey, everyone. You can find me at NemesisFC2. And all I'm going to say is, all right. And if you stay tuned in after that horrible rendition, you are a true fan.
Welcome to Steve Shade Wing Sellers. Where can we find you on Twitter, Steve?
Oh, hi. I am on Twitter at Shade Wing. And I will say that I would much rather listen to Kiss, even Nemesis' rendition of Kiss, over Billy Joel.
Welcome to Jeff, Dr. Fade Bracey. Where can we find you on Twitter, Jeff?
It would be at Bracey452. That's B-R-A-C-E-Y 452. I'm here with my umbrella because the apocalypse is rolling in like a storm front.
Oh, lots of foreshadowing there. All right, we're going to start with Umbrella Academy, Season 2, Episode 4, entitled The Majestic 12. Now, for some reason, this episode decided to slow everything down, although we had a few good fight scenes, but it was definitely a relationship-focused episode. And most of that really kind of got on my nerves. And the reason being because, again, as we've talked about many times, each one of their individual characters and or storylines is only mildly compelling at best. It's when they're together that the show is strongest, except for Five. He's the only one we could follow solo and just be completely entertained and intertwined in what's going on. Because he and Vanya are basically always driving the action. So hoping that kind of bottoms out and evens out before season's end. So what happens in this episode is the most significant advancement we get in the story is the idea of the Majestic 12 themselves, which is another JFK conspiracy theory. And we see that Hargreaves is right smack dab in the middle of it, which we shouldn't be surprised at that. One of the better moments, because this is basically about each one of the characters confronting something in the past, confronting something that they need to deal with, that they may not want to deal with, or that they're just really kind of blown away by. So Diego meets Mom, the real Mom, the real woman that the robot Mom was patterned after. Allison and Luther get together and not get together, but, you know, reunite. Maybe that's a better way to say it. And have an awkward conversation about the fact that she's married and has a life. Klaus finds David, and that relationship kind of comes to an end before it even happens. And Luther keeps spilling the beans to Elliot when they get drunk together, which is actually really kind of funny. Five confronts Hargreaves and says something to him in another language, probably a code that only they know. Maybe they said it before and I missed it in the show. But again, it's interesting because it makes you wonder if Hargreaves isn't pulling the strings behind all of this. And again, he's still the most exciting character, probably because there's still so much mystery to him, even more so than Five. Even though Five is the most entertaining and the most compelling, Hargreaves as the dark Professor X, the dark Niles Calder, if you can be darker than Niles Calder, still so compelling. And Vanya finally hooks up with Sissy, and they kind of give in to what they've been feeling for a long time, which we knew it was coming because it was kind of obvious from their first scene together because the tension was so high and Sissy is so disconnected from her husband. So none of that was really a surprise. So before we get into that stuff, the relationship stuff, which we've actually talked about quite a bit, here's one I want to throw out. I want to throw out the question of what type of time travel model are they using? And here's the reason why. Okay. The first scene, we see Lila's parents being killed, and that's set in 1993 London. But the world is supposed to end in 1963, according to the current season storyline. So doesn't that already tell us that they avoid it? And also, again, the point about Hargreaves, does he get what's going on? Does he know who he's looking at? Because I'm pretty sure that he does. So I know we talked about it a little bit before, but I want to hear your thoughts about exactly what type of time travel model. Is this the Terminator model where the past, you know, causes the future, or 12 monkeys where you can't change the past and everything you do was going to happen anyway and it still makes the future happen? Or is it the Back to the Future model where you have split time streams? Because it seems like it's all supposed to be one universe or whatever, but I don't know. It's getting a little confusing. So I know we talked about it before, but I want to dive into it again because I'm trying to understand, you know, how they didn't just tell us with this episode everything that's going to happen since 1993 still happened. So let me hear your thoughts about that. Start with Steve.
Okay. My best guess, based on what I've seen so far, is it's probably somewhere between the Terminator model and maybe with a little bit of Doctor Who. And I'm saying this because my feeling is that there probably are fixed points in time, like they've established there, where there are just certain events that happen, and no matter what you do, this thing has to exist, or these turn of events have to happen in some form. So I think the apocalypse probably qualifies as a fixed point. The thing is that when you try to change it, it just happens in a different way, or it happens at a different time. But I do think it is a single linear model, and whatever changes you make are permanent, and it changes the time stream from there. What I think we saw this episode in 1992 was this was the original track of time, and we're looking at the past of Diego's girlfriend. I forget her name. but we're kind of seeing, yeah, okay, Lila or whatever her name was. But the idea is we're seeing her past from her perspective at that time. So we're seeing her being rescued by the handler. We're seeing her being raised by the handler and growing up. And I will also add one suspicion that I have, which is I think the guy that killed her parents is going to turn out to be Five, which is why they didn't show him. So I think that may very well come back later if that's the case. And that actually interests me more than a lot of the other things that was going on, because just about everything around Five is interesting. But yeah, I think it's basically that kind of thing, but with a certain element that there are points that are fixed and that are very difficult to change, if not impossible.
Fixed and difficult to change. I've never particularly bought into that theory. I understand it, but I just don't buy it. But it depends on how fluid, I guess, you think time is. And then we have to factor in free will and consequences and the whole glass splintering thing. So, yeah. Okay, go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, this is interesting. For me, I think there's two different answers I can give you. One is my geek answer, which I'll give you second. The first answer is from a writing perspective, I don't think they have a concept of time. I think they're just playing fast and loose with it and doing what they want. So
probably.
From a geek perspective, for me, the closest thing I could tie it to would be kind of like the way Reverse Flash experiences time. In other words, he can step outside of time and exist even when he shouldn't have been born. So it's almost like people that start traveling in time create their own time streams. And eventually that can catch up to you. And, you know, if your birth was erased, as the Umbrella Academy's birth should have been erased, if time had ended in 1966, then, you know, that could catch up to you. But once you start hopping around in time, you kind of step outside of it. So, for instance, you know, when during Flashpoint, Reverse Flash would never have even been born when Barry put all the instances, you know, Barry succumbed to Reverse Flash's, Eobard Thawne's whole plan there and everything. But because he's a time traveler, you know, he was even able to keep going after he'd been shot in the head. If you follow the animation, you know, what they did with that and stuff like that. So I think that's kind of what's going on here, is that these people start traveling through time. The, whatever that organization is called, those agents are traveling through time, so it's almost like they set themselves outside whatever the timeline is and what changes are wrought there. That's kind of what I think.
Okay, that one makes the most sense to me, that there is an independent existence from the time stream. Mm-hmm. And when one begins to dip in and out, one can affect whatever one chooses, but it doesn't necessarily have to flow in all the directions it might flow in. Which is why Thawne is still alive after Eddie killed himself.
Right.
So, yeah, okay, that I can follow. Go ahead, Bracey.
All right, I'm going to give you a third option. I'm going to go with the causality loop. as you rightly noticed, by giving us a flash forward to 1992, it seems to invalidate the 1960s timeline. It's entirely possible that what Five sees, because he is that person who can step inside and outside of time, is he sees the potentials or the possibilities of the time stream. He's not necessarily living it like the rest of it. So the apocalypse born of the 1960s, I think, could very well be established by Diego actually saving the president. And that escalates the Cuban Missile Crisis to the point where Russia feels like they have no choice but to invade. So there's that. But okay, that hasn't happened yet. So what I think is happening is that by these characters going into the past, the causality loop basically says, like, you know, if like there's this cool movie, I believe it's called Time Rider, where Fred Ward is this motocross racer. He goes back in the past. He's stuck there. He's trying to figure out how to get back. And he explains to this woman there how, like, my grandfather, like, lived in this area a long time ago. I was like, don't know much about him. Grandma says, like, just, you know, grandma and him had one incredible night together. And then, you know, my father was born, that kind of thing. It turns out Fred Ward is his own granddad. So somehow, in the interest keys, in the timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly stuff, you can actually make time even though you weren't there yet by traveling back in time, the causality loop. You cause this timeline. I think everything they are doing is setting up things that we have seen and will see in the present. I think that Five showing up and talking to his father is going to set up him wanting to investigate who these strange people are he's encountered, both Diego and Five. I'm sure soon the others in concert. I think Klaus going to see his future lover has definitely pushed him via his uncle into enlisting into the Vietnam War. I think they're making their own future and past without even realizing it.
I got you. Okay. That's viable as well. the only thing I would want is there needs to be some type of consistent rules for any of the decisions to have weight. And like we talked about last time, mm-hmm. I really think that Ray, Allison's husband, it would just be an incredible twist if he ends up being against mutants in the future. Or if he's the one that, you know, because this episode reminded me a lot of the first X-Men in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And it would really be something if he ends up changing the movement either to include them because of his love for Allison or to exclude them because of his fear of Allison. So hopefully that shows up at some point. Okay, next thing is I want you to give me your most favorite moment and your least favorite moment from this episode. If you don't have both, that's cool, but just give me like the thing that jumped out at you the most, like, man, that was awesome, or like, I can't stand it. I'll start. The thing that I liked the most about this particular episode was once again seeing Vanya's powers. They're like magic genie powers. They can be whatever she needs them to be. But just the sight of telekinetically lifting an entire pond to find her stepson or whatever, I thought was just so awesome. And it was one of the few good uses of powers in this episode, because so much of it was talky, walky, timey, wimey. And the thing that I could not stand is every time Lila's on the screen, and the only thing I hate more than Lila is Lila and the handler. And there you have it. Go ahead, Bracey. Best or worst?
For me, it's pretty easy. I got to go with the fight scene. As you mentioned, this episode's a bit slower overall than previous episodes. I love the hallway fight scene. You know, having the Kiss music in there was a lot of fun. On top of that, when you were talking about a flashback to the X-Men, I had the flashback. I always enjoy seeing Five fight, because like Nightcrawler, he's a teleporter.
Yeah.
And that's just a really fun fighting dynamic to have in there. And then seeing Diego really get to go to town on one of the Swedes was a lot of fun as well. So yeah, that was very enjoyable. And that felt like a payoff that was just, it just needed to come, because like you said, a lot of the episode was too slow, too much focusing on individual relationships. If we'd seen like maybe one or two during the episode, and that was my least favorite part overall, is just too much of that. We don't need to see like these sort of resolutions of this relationship. It was too much. It really started to feel very Hallmark to me at that point.
I think they're trying to build some type of empathy to pull us in, but again, the characters aren't strong enough on their own yet for that. Mm-hmm. The X-Men could do it, but these are still kind of the diet X-Men. But I did like the fight scene too as well. Teleportation is the second best power behind speed to have. If you don't have super speed, then you need to be able to teleport, because that's one that, you know, unless you have an energy field like the Paladins and Jumper, you can't really see teleportation. Like, how?
I would also make a strong argument for telekinesis. It's such an omni power.
Depending on how strong it is, I mean, if it gives you a headache when you use it, you know, because the Hulk normally just pounds against Sue Storm's shields and she gets a headache. So if you can do it effortlessly, that's cool. But if it taxes your brain the way lifting something would tax like your biceps.
Yeah, let's go with the Siler levels of TK.
Oh, okay. Well, go ahead, Steve.
Okay. As far as the best scenes, Jeff already took mine, so I'll go give you my second best one, which was Ray and Allison having their confrontation. Because I had thought coming in that, you know, Ray was going to call her out on her having this power. And it turns out he didn't even realize that she'd used the power. It never occurred to him that she did. So he assumes that what happened is that she is some kind of a plant that has been infiltrating the group the entire time. And now he no longer trusts her because she can't explain herself without admitting, yeah, I have superpowers. I'm like, okay, yeah, that explains his weird behavior the last couple of episodes. That makes a lot of sense. That explains his behavior towards her now. And that was like, okay, I can get into that. I can buy that. That made a lot of sense to me. Which is, even though I really find this whole business with Allison clearly being forced back with Luther, you know, a little annoying, I like that moment. So that was my good moment. The bad moment was, and this is really more of a missed opportunity, I kind of felt, the whole business with Vanya saving the kid. Firstly, she lifted telekinetically the entire lake, you know, high in the air. Did the wife not see this? I mean, it was high enough in the air. She should have been able to see this from like way out. And she never, like, asks her about this, calls her on this, or anything else. No, we have this forced relationship in there. We don't see, you know, Vanya reacting to the idea, like, oh, my God, I'm ridiculously powerful. I'm the Dark Phoenix now. What am I supposed to do about that? There's none of that. It's just let's set up the romance with this woman, which I don't care about. When virtually anything that they had done, you know, dealing with the outcome of her saving the kid, you know, would have been more interesting than that. What a complete missed opportunity on so many levels. I mean, the kid not, you know, having any questioning about any of this. You know, how does this relate to the kid? There's so many ways they could have gone with this, and instead it's just, oh, we're just going to use it to get these two characters together. What a waste.
Yeah, I thought about that too, but I was just like, okay, comic book. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Well, I will say, Jeff also took my favorite part, but it also contains my least favorite part as well. So I will get to that. So my second favorite part of this episode was the wink and nod to little things within the episode, two in particular. One was Grace, mom. The fact that she was a real person, and that somewhere along the line, this twisted individual, Hargreaves, turned her or her likeness into a robot. That's a whole story I want to know. I want to know what kind of sick action resulted in him turning either the actual person into a robot or taking her likeness when she was presumably gone and making a robot. That is really interesting to me. And then the second part is the fact that they used MJ-12, Majestic 12, since Majestic 12 is also associated with Roswell and aliens and stuff. Hint, hint, spoiler for other stuff that those who have read the comics know about Umbrella Academy. So I thought that was cool, a cool wink and nod. I like that. My least favorite thing, if no woman fighter ever does the Hurricane Rana again and tries to do the flippity-foo, grab onto the neck, and then flip people, I will be a happy man. And then on top of that, in this fight scene, Lila goes for the flippity-foo, and misses it, and is sitting there facing him. I don't know if it was forward or backward, and it really doesn't matter, because at that point, you're a sitting duck. And for once, if someone misses that move, which is ridiculous all by itself, because you're going to miss it most of the time, you should get crushed. Lila should have gotten thrown out the window or something, you know? So it's like, yes, I love the fight scene. It was really good, but I am so tired of it. It is so overplayed. I was like, I would love for someone one time to really, in a street fight, try and pull off that move and see how badly you would get destroyed. So that's my little, you know, problem with that fight scene.
Well, to me, it's not that much different from the first time we saw Bullet Time in The Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
The first time we see Trinity do the Flying Eagle, man, everybody's mouth dropped open. We were like, holy cow. And then all of a sudden, Bullet Time was everywhere.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, we just got burnt out on it. And so seeing Black Widow fight like that is always kind of the quintessential character that I want to see use that, because that's identified with her style. But every superhero female is not supposed to fight like that. So I definitely agree with what you're saying.
Absolutely. And then, you know, I'll just add, you know, growing up here in Southern California and being a huge wrestling fan, I've seen that particular move and Lucha Libre my entire adult life, or entire life growing up. So, you know, when it came into Black Widow, I thought it was cool, but now I've seen it everywhere. I'm just like, holy man. So.
Now I want to talk about my second favorite moment, and then I want to throw out a question that's along the lines of Writer's Code. My second favorite moment was when finally, and I mean finally, can you hear me say finally? Finally, Amen. Somebody called out Lila to her face, and it was Five. Mm. He smelled a rat, and he called it.
Mm.
I just about got up out of my chair and was like, yes! I was fist pumping, I was air pumping, I was like, oh! Oh, because I can't stand
my immediate anymore. Reaction to that scene was, oh my God, Dave is really going to love this.
You know me well, my friend. And so The writer's code question I want to throw out to you is, why does it seem like writing protagonists as intelligent and or perceptive is the exception and not the rule? Because I told you, just like the first time I saw Girardi, I was like, nope, nope, nothing but trouble. Nothing good is going to happen. I could smell it coming. And as soon as I saw Lila, I was like, nope, nope, can't stand her, nope. And it's like, you know, maybe because I'm that way, I like to see characters that act that way. But Five, man, he didn't pull any punches. He didn't try to sugarcoat it. He didn't try to be politically correct, which wouldn't be a thing back then anyway. But he was like, yeah, no, you might fool Diego, but you don't fool me. I thought he was going to take her out on the spot, but he probably wanted to see how things played out. But yeah, so tell me from the writer's code point of view, why don't we get more characters that seem to be able, I said it in a tweet not too long ago, everybody always instantly recognizes the villains except the hero. Why is that? Start with Nemesis.
Well, I think you just hit on it right there. You know, you've a lot of writers, you know, you've got the plot, you've got where you want the story to go. But the hard part is getting inside characters' heads and writing them in a consistent and intellectually consistent way, you know. So if you write a character like Five, well, let's put Five aside for a second, but, you know, you write any character and you write them like you would in real life, most of the time the villains are going to lose before they can even get past square one, because unless you can come up with some very inventive and creative ways to create crimes and hide that from the heroes or the protagonists. And that can be very difficult. That takes a lot of thinking about how would you do this? What are the moves, counter moves, stuff like that. And really, I think what it comes down to is, I hate to say it, but it's almost like laziness. It's not necessarily laziness. It's just, it's easier to write it that way than to sit and try and come up with a whole series of events and moves and stuff that make sense and are consistent from a logical real world standpoint.
Okay. A lot to unpack there. I'll be chewing on that for a while. Go ahead, Bracey.
Yeah, this is a really interesting question, because I know, I'm sure all of you as well as myself have seen this sort of thing done and done well, where, you know, the villain isn't obvious, or like when that heel turn comes and you're like, holy crap, I never suspected that guy being, you know, doing all that. So, you know, it can be done. You know, it's such an interesting trope that I love that in the Joss Whedon produced movie Cabin in the Woods, that he and I think Drew Goddard was the other writer on it, that they had written in a scene where the people trapped in the cabin with all these zombies attacking, they're like, all right, you know, whatever we do, we stay together. And you're like, yeah, somebody's doing something smart. And the guys in the control room hit Chris Hemsworth with some gas. Like, no, what was I thinking? We should all split up, because that's the dumb thing to do. And that's what they need them to do, because they're all sacrifices to this whole Eldritch game they're playing. Which was a brilliant little nod and a wink to that sort of thing. Why do people in movies do dumb things? Because, like you, that is a huge pet peeve of mine. I can't stand when supposedly intelligent characters do dumb things. Now, I can buy Diego and Luthor falling into this sort of trope, because, you know, they're obviously very physically inclined and not so intellectual. But when you see people like Rumor or Vanya or Fives, and I'm like you, I was so glad Fives called it out. And we know that you have this predilection. You love the characters to just call out everybody's BS right off the get-go. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely nice to see that happen. My wondering about it is it the process that goes into a TV show? Now, in comic books, since this is comic book related, we've seen writers handle this sort of thing very well. And some of these writers who write some of the best Batman stories, for instance, are some of these true crime authors who get into true crime or even fictional crime, who get into writing Batman because they think it's a fun challenge to write the Dark Knight detective. So we know for a fact that solo authors can do it. But I wonder sometimes if in the process, and working for a studio in this kind of committee setting, if that waters down the whole writing experience?
Now, that right there, I think that's definitely true, because you can see writing by committee when it's on the screen. You can hear when characters say things that are so totally out of character, you know, that some suit somewhere said, well, they should say this. Well, they should do that. And the audience just goes like, no. Have you met them? So, yeah, I definitely agree with that committee thing. The too many cooks thing happens all the time. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I would say that is part of it. I think a lot of it, though, is just laziness. Some writers are just, you know, not very sophisticated in the way that they do things. And they just want the easiest path from point A and point B, which is, I need this to happen. And so for this, I need these people to be able to fool them. But not every writer takes the time and care to make it actually make sense. To actually go through the motions and show how, you know, they would be able to fool these sorts of characters. And, you know, how do you incorporate that into the backstory? And like, clearly the writers of Picard did no such thing with Girardi. And we saw there that like characters that should have at least been suspicious say absolutely nothing and in fact fall under her spell, which is complete nonsense. So that's like an extreme example, but it's still just lazy writing for the most part. I think with the Umbrella Academy, it actually works, because for the most part, you're dealing with characters that, you know, shall we say, are not the brightest candle out there, except for Five, obviously, and like a couple of the others. I mean, Allison at least has common sense. Vanya is somewhat sensible. But I mean, you know, do I buy Diego being fooled? Oh, yeah. I mean, he's been portrayed as kind of an idiot for a while. Luther is a guy who, you know, just goes through the motions, you know, lives in self-pity and doesn't really think about very much. He's definitely more a physical oriented guy. And he definitely is not, you know, thinking about, you know, the larger game the way that a character like Five would or that Hargreaves would. But I mean, again, that's taking a certain amount of writing, you know, being aware of the character and ask, OK, how would this character react to this? And what would be the consequence of that? You know, kind of following that and then trying to account for those issues. You know, OK, how do you fool a guy like Five who's smarter than I am and, you know, has knowledge of the future and all these sorts of things? But that, again, that takes intellectual effort. That takes, you know, working things out and mapping things out, at least in your head, reasonably well. And I think that we definitely see at least some difference between the writing on the Umbrella Academy, where they at least kind of note that, yeah, not everybody's buying into this. So the writers are also cueing into us as well. Yeah, we know where we're going with this. You guys don't trust her. You shouldn't trust her. And we're showing that because Five doesn't trust her either. That's always a good technique to be able to work in there, especially since it raises tension. You know, what's going to happen next? You know, is he going to expose her? Is he going to find out what she's really doing? Or does she take him out before she can warn the others? That kind of thing. So you get a certain amount in there. But I would say, yeah, largely, I think it's just lazy writing, and good writers tend to avoid that.
A great example, Dave, I think what Steve and I were talking about, in the book that I'm currently writing, one of the bad players in the book introduces a vaccine which causes all sorts of genetic problems and stuff, and on purpose, but in order to hide it over a number of years, I did weeks worth of research on shell companies and FDA regulations and stuff to find out how somebody could actually do that and remain off the radar. Versus I could have just said, well, nobody caught it, you know, and moved on.
Yeah, show your work.
Yeah, I know. That makes a lot of sense. In my novel, I'm working on the sequel. My novel's about the war in heaven. And because the biggest question that would immediately jump out is, how could such a thing happen? How could a perfect environment or a perfect place or a place of joy or whatever, how could that possibly spark rebellion? If you're an angel in the heavenly realm, why would you not want to be that?
Right.
And so there are many, many different ways I answer the question. But yeah, it was after a long thought process.
So I think that speaks to the whole I think that speaks to the committee issue as well, because writing individual projects like this, where you don't have a deadline per se, you have the luxury of taking the time to do that research or to work out those thought exercises to figure out where you're going to go. So it's not an excuse for the writers, but I understand a little bit at least.
I think you have a point, and I think you could also end up having the greatest idea of the world and running into a suit that we'll say is not the most intellectually gifted and doesn't get what you're doing, and then it just gets mixed. So.
No, that's very true as well. And I always wonder about how do they estimate the audience's intelligence? I know we tend to be lumped and grouped, but all people aren't the same. I personally love thinking man's science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I love detail, that kind of thing. I love it when it's been thought out. I love hiding things in plain sight. I love a whole bunch of stuff. So I respond more to that kind of stuff. But when stuff is generic and cliched and you can call out the end of the movie within the first 15 minutes, then, you know, I'm like bored. I'm like, I wonder what my friends are doing on Twitter. I'm like, wait a minute. Have I talked to my sister today? I mean, my mind just goes other places because I'm like, okay, well, you know, you need to show me something new. So I don't know if that comes from being a writer, if it comes from being a longtime sci-fi and fantasy fan, or I don't know, maybe it's a combination. I don't know. But that tends to smack me in the face, too. What do the creators think of the audience? Because that's not something you can hide as a writer. So what do you think of your readers? You know, how do you think they're going to respond to what you're saying? Okay, next question with Umbrella Academy is, it was a real Back to the Future moment when Diego meets Real Grace, the model for Robo Grace. I want to take a deeper dive into what Nemesis said because that was quite intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of mind creates a robot duplicate of your dead wife, ex-wife, whatever she was, or maybe your girlfriend or whatever happened? Because to me, again, it speaks to the depravity of Hargreaves. But what I want to know is, do you think he's extreme in the sense of being depraved, or do you think he's extreme in the sense of anything for science, which is not necessarily the same character trait? Some people do things because their love for science and their love for exploration pushes them to extremes. That's kind of the Reed Richards model. But some people do things because they're just sick. And the way their mind works is just, it's ghastly. So what do you think about Hargreaves? Like, which way does it go? Is he equal parts? Or does he lean one more toward the other? And I don't want to spoil the, you know, what's coming up, because I don't want to drop that yet. But just based on what we know now, what do you think about him? I'll start with Steve.
Yeah, I'm kind of leaning towards somewhere in the middle because, you know, okay, yeah, he can build a sophisticated lifelike android. Why does he choose her? Why, of all people that he needed for that role, does he choose that woman, and for what reason? And it could be, you know, something deeply depraved. It could also be on some level that, you know, he did something bad to her, and maybe this is his way of atoning in a twisted way, you know, by bringing her back in this form. It's really kind of hard to say. I mean, he keeps his feelings very much under wrap if he has any at all. But I do think some of it also is the science aspect. And I think some of it was also that he knew that he needed someone to take care of the kids because he couldn't do it. He knew he was not qualified to do it. And he wasn't interested in doing it. I mean, we mostly have seen Hargreaves, you know, just go on to his next project or doing his next thing. And, you know, he doesn't spend any time with them. He needs somebody, you know, to fill that role. And so, you know, OK, yeah, I'll devise an android, you know, that can basically be nanny bot. But if you're going to do that, you know, who do you model it off of? You know, maybe he had a particular affection for her, or maybe, you know, there he kind of felt like it was some way of resolving some issue in the past that we're not privy to. You know, so yeah, I think it's probably somewhere in the middle.
Okay, go ahead, Bracey.
I'm going to have to go somewhere in the middle as well. I think Steve really hit on all the points that I was going to hit on. because just given the limited amount of information we've gotten on Harvard Reeves so far, my suspicion, and as a writer, I think this would be a great way to humanize the character a bit, because we haven't seen anything to really humanize him just yet. I'm thinking part of this decision might be based on guilt. Like Steve, I suspect that he might have been responsible for something very horrible happening to her. So it's, I'm thinking it's a guilt thing, a little bit of a, like you said, sort of a redemptive factor. It's like, I'll give her this quote unquote sort of second life. She'll serve a purpose. I would like to say there's an affection involved, but like with Hargreaves, we just don't know enough about the man to say one way or the other on that. And that seems a lot less likely given what we know, the fact that he is very clinically, scientifically driven to just kind of do things. So still up in the air about it, but I'm going to go somewhere in the middle as well.
Okay. Go ahead, Nemesis.
I'm definitely going to lean to one side, and I'm going to say that, in my opinion, I think Hargreaves is a pragmatic, ends justify the means type person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, because he is so focused on that, I don't think he realizes that his actions can be interpreted by a real human being, you know, someone who is a thinking, rational, you know, thinking, emotional, human being, as ghastly and depraved, you know. And so, depending on which way, if I was writing this, I wanted to portray Hargreaves, you know, what his tragedy is of the fact that he's detached and so scientific and pragmatic about this stuff, you know, then you could choose, you know, it's multiple choice. It's like you could make it that he did something horrible to her and he's doing it out of some way to assuage his guilt, or you could make it that the only time he thought of, you know, when he thought of love and compassion and caring for somebody, immediately this person came to mind, he did that. If you really wanted to make him ghastly, you could make it that that she died and he hauled out her body and created the robot from that. I mean, that's just depraved and horrible and scientific, you know. So there's so many ways you could go with it, and that's why I think it's a very interesting little tidbit in there that I wish they would explore more.
So we went Bride of Frankenstein on her, possibly. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a whole new can of worms right there. Yeah. Okay. Well, once again, he still remains the most interesting character because we don't know enough about him to draw some solid conclusions. But 5 is definitely still compelling and still right up there with him in terms of being interesting and someone who we want to continue to follow. We would even follow a solo series of 5. His adventures through time would be incredible, especially continuing to run into his older self. Always hilarious. So, okay. All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up there. This episode really felt like it was full of transitions and full of things that were setting up things to come. And, you know, so we know that there's more stuff to come that's going to give us some more answers. But, you know, so slower paced, a little bit of action, mostly relationship-based stuff. But a lot of it just kind of underscores the fact that we want them to get on with it. That was my general feeling after watching this episode. I'm like, oh, that's good. That's nice. But get on with it. We need to get on with it. We need to see where this is going. All right, we're going to take a little bit of a break here, a 5-minute break. We want you to hear from our sponsor here about the other things we're doing on the United Capes Podcast Network. And we'll come back after our break and we're going to discuss The Boys, Season 2, Episode 4.
Coming soon on October 24th, 2020, Comic Crusaders presents Virtual Con 2, only on ComicCrusaders.com.
All right, folks, welcome back. We're going to talk about Season 2, Episode 4 of The Boys, entitled Nothing Like It in the World. First thing I want to bring up is the character of Huey, which is not my favorite because he's whipped, same reason I don't like Luther. He's just like a beta orbiter. I'm like, dude, could you possibly get a life? But anyway, that's not what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about him as the canary in the coal mine, the conscience, the one that's always singing the moral and ethical tunes to the people around him. What do you feel about that approach or that view of Huey? Start with Bracey.
Yeah, it's interesting. We didn't get a chance to talk about this last week, and this is why I wanted to bring this back up again, because I thought it was a really interesting point to make. The fact that Huey is very much a beta male, and yet we've seen him slowly assert himself. He's had to go places he never would have or thought he could have gone. But at the same time, it's still all too much for him. And Mother's Milk had to make Butcher realize, you know, there's a point that Huey just cannot exceed. And I think more importantly, because Huey has become the heart of the group, if the canary in the coal mine dies, so does the group. They can't go just off of Butcher. You know, we know from their past history that they can't. Butcher will eventually lead them into disaster one way or another. So they need Huey. Huey is the glue that's holding them together, and he's the one who's maintaining the moral compass for the group. Because you know, Frenchie and Mother's Milk just really want to do their own thing. But Huey is the guy who seems to be able to straddle that fine line for them. Yes, I want to do the right thing, but I want to do it the right way and for the right reasons. So I think Huey's important in that aspect. And, of course, Huey's also the audience. He's the audience character. So if he can't take it anymore, then we as an audience can't take it anymore.
Very true. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I actually kind of like these characters for the most part. The example that I would like to throw out, or at least a couple of them, one of them is Nightcrawler with the X-Men. He's usually the guy that will usually call Wolverine out when he goes too far. You know, he's generally going, because he's a man of faith and he has certain principles. I was recently the other day reading the Milestone book Icon. That had another good example of this, Rocket. And she is this wonderful teenage girl character, you know, who kind of lives in the world. Whereas, you know, the superhero that she's working with, Icon, is somebody who is completely out of touch because he's an alien, because he's immortal, and because he's privileged. And so she's always the one saying, you know, this is how real people live. This is, you know, how heroes act. You know, this is what you should be doing. So I definitely have affection for that. I just don't particularly like Huey in specific for some of the same reasons you do, DT. I just find that he's a lot of times he's just whining constantly and he's annoying. Less so in this episode, to be fair. I feel like that because Starlight was there, he was more tolerable, but at the same time, that kind of shows a certain codependency he has with her, which isn't a whole lot better. But I mean, I feel like that the role is important. I think Huey is trying his best to fill it. I just find that there are better, and honestly, even in the comics, he's better at it than this version is. I don't know if it's the actor, I don't know if it's the writing, but I just find that this particular version of Huey tries to be that character, but unfortunately they don't let him actually get there. The whole moment earlier in the season when he was talking about being Harry Potter, that would have been fine, but then he never falls through on it. And the previous episode, same thing. This is going to be the time when I'm going to stand up and I'm going to be that guy. And he just never is. So I appreciate the idea of him having that role. But it's just that Starlight does it better than Huey does. Yes. And so, you know, as much as I would like to be behind Huey, unless they can actually develop him and have him follow through, I just feel like he is not a really good character in that mold, personally.
Now, you want to know one of the best examples I've ever seen of doing that right was John Connor on Sarah Connor Chronicles. Because he starts out, he's very whiny, very reluctant, very resistant, doesn't want to deal with it. I can't take it. You've got to stop him. I don't want this life. But by the time they finish the second season, he's very much warmed into and in the track of becoming the John Connor that we know. And you can see the physical transformation. The actor did such a good job. I mean, yeah, so it can be done. It can definitely be done, but so far with you, it seems like maybe they're dragging it out. I don't know. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I'm going to build a little bit on what Steve said, but go a little different direction. When I hear that he's the canary in the coal mine, I definitely agree with Steve that, you know, and both NDT as well, that he's this, you know, he's a beta male who's trying to improve himself and asserts himself sometimes. And I think what canary in the coal mine means is that if things have gotten so bad, if you have gone so far off the reservation that Huey is willing to stand up to you and tell you, no, we're not going to do that, then you've gone pretty far, because Huey is so beta and non-confrontational that it takes some level of, you know, badness on a epic scale for him to actually stand up and find his manhood and say something. So
I'll add one other thing. There's one other character who does it better than Huey does, and that is Becca. We'll talk about it later, but I actually thought that she was very good at calling him out on his nonsense when it was important, and pointing out that you're going too far, you know? So yeah, she's great in that role, but Huey has not caught up with her.
Okay. Very interesting. Okay. Just to give a brief recap of this episode, I would describe this episode basically as, once again, it slowed down to focus in on relationships, but this was the transition episode. To me, that's the difference between this episode of The Boys and Umbrella Academy. This episode transitioned, okay? It clearly set us up for whatever corners are going to be turned next. And even though it had to slow down to do it, it lost a little bit of momentum, but it still makes me want to follow through. So to give a brief recap, we basically see Homelander falling apart and throwing as much of a tantrum as he knows how as a superpowered child. And that's going to increase as time goes on. We see a scene we'll talk about in terms of Madeline Stillwell, and that whole thing creeped me out. We should understand, if you haven't read the comics, you should understand who Stormfront is by now. And we'll talk about that. There's a big reveal with her, but it's been in front of us this whole time. We have Becca and Butcher kind of defining where they're going to go from here. And it's not what we thought, but it is what we thought. We have Huey and Starlight kind of defining where they're going to go. We have Frenchie still trying to make amends with Kimiko, even through hooking up with his side chick and coming face to face with what he's really doing in terms of why he's so obsessed with Kimiko. And so even though it slowed down, and even though it wasn't, we also have Maeve being outed, which was huge, outed on national TV live. And then once again, we have the Deep on the side doing something that we don't even care about. But anyway, so same question as before. Let's go through our favorite and least favorite moments. I had so many moments that I liked in this one, even though it was slower, until it's really hard for me to pick one, to be honest. But if I have to pick one, I guess I'd have to say Black Noir and the tech, where he's communicating without saying anything, makes him even more scary, makes him an even more disturbed Batman-esque figure, because, you know, Batman's my favorite. Also, I don't know if everybody knows that Black Noir is actually a black guy. You know, that becomes apparent later, but that shouldn't be too much of a spoiler if you follow them on Instagram, because they posted pictures of the actor many times. So I don't know if the character is supposed to be African-American. I'm assuming he is, but the actor, yes. The actor most certainly is. But it had to be that moment where...
They're following that trope of, like, so many black characters being named Black This or Black That.
Right. And so that had to be my most favorite. My least favorite is a tie between the breakup between Becca and Butcher and the breakup between Hugh and Starlight. I didn't buy either one of them. It was the closest I've seen this show come to the characters being out of character. Because both of them, I thought, were just, nah, I didn't buy it. I'll briefly explain why. I didn't buy Huey and Starlight because they're both so obviously still into each other. And all of a sudden, Starlight becomes pessimistic. She becomes a character without hope. In just one season, she's gone from the most hopeful, naive, optimistic, I want to see the best in people, I want to be a real hero. Remember, she said that at the end of season one, I'm here because I'm a superhero. And now all of a sudden, she's drunk the Kool-Aid so deeply, so quickly, until she says, we can't allow ourselves a moment of happiness because Homelander cornered her in the elevator. That's not the first time her life's been threatened. But now all of a sudden, she can't relax and enjoy a moment. And you juxtapose that to the fact that they're out in public and they were on a road trip. So you're clearly not too worried about Homelander finding you, because nothing about this operation was covert. No, just did not buy it. And I didn't buy Becca and Butcher because both of them should have seen that coming, but it wouldn't be something that Butcher wouldn't get. Why in the world he would think, how could he know his wife and think that she'd be willing to leave the kid? How? And also, why would Becca think that they were just going to run off and just be this little family? Really? Really? Hide how? Living a life on the run underground in his little bunker with the rest of the boys? And both of them are too smart for how they acted. So I don't know. I didn't buy it. Those are my least favorite moments. So let me hear from you guys. Best and worst. Start with Bracing.
Worst is pretty easy. It's once again the deep. the whole thing. I kept wondering, like we keep seeing these women's interviews, and every time that would pop up, at first I was like, okay, what's all this about? And then it became very like, I don't care. And then it became very annoying because these little things kept interrupting the flow of the story for me. It's like, I don't understand what this little sidebar is. And frankly, I don't even care anymore. And when it's finally revealed, the payoff for it sucked. I just hate it. Like, can we move on from the deep? He's a character we don't care about. It's not fun to make fun of him. His little side quest doesn't matter. Although I'm sure at some point they're probably going to get him back involved with the Seven or into the Seven somehow. So, but I really didn't care. If I was going to go for a second, I would have gone for your pick, DT. Like you said, it was clear from the get-go. Butcher, with his loathing of supers, would never accept a super kid, even if it was half Becca. That was never going to happen. Like you said, they were never going to run off and be a happy little family. So it doesn't make sense for either of those characters, as smart as they are, to even pretend that for any amount of time.
That's right.
Best scene for me is like, I will take the Black Noir as my number two, because that was so excellent. So beautifully in character for that character. But I am really so invested in everything Homelander. And the creepy scene of him recreating his dead pseudo mother lover via doppelganger is just, I was like, it's such a train wreck. I can't take my eyes off of watching this guy deconstruct right in front of me. A terrifically unnerving scene.
And what makes Homelander so scary is that he's a child with godlike power. He's
exactly
like Captain Marvel. Everything we love about Billy Batson is flipped in Homelander. And people keep thinking he's the anti-Superman. He's Superman-esque, but he's really the anti-Captain Marvel.
No, you've really hit on it, because he's, like you said, he's the child. He's even called a child a couple of times by people in authority who aren't afraid to stand up to him, like the CEO of the company. Yeah, like So the people recognize what's his mother lover figure's name again?
Stillwell.
Stillwell. She called him a child before. It's so apparent, but he doesn't have that whole wisdom of Solomon to balance him out.
That's right.
So yeah, he's utterly terrifying. If you having somebody with that stunted emotional growth, we all know how unreasonable, how cruel, and how potentially violent children can be. And you give them unlimited power, run for the hills. That's right. That Twilight Zone episode all over again with the kid who had the reality altering powers. Get the hell out of there.
And he's addicted to breast milk. Get out of here with that. Go ahead, Nemesis.
I need to find some Maalox. Hold on. All right. My least favorite moment is the stuff with Becca and Butcher. Specifically Butcher. I didn't see it the same way you guys did necessarily. I mean, I understand why Butcher hates Homelander. I understand why Butcher hates a lot of soups because he can see that most of them are decadent and other stuff. I can see why he doesn't trust Starlight because she's part of the Seven and he's had past experience with adult soups. But then taking that and doing that to a kid, you know, projecting that onto a kid who doesn't seem to have any of those is another step above for me. And it didn't make a whole lot of sense character-wise. To me, it would make more sense character-wise that he might have a problem with it, with the type of person Butcher is, that this kid reminds him of the fact that his wife was raped by Homelander or something like that. So I didn't buy it the same way you guys did, but for a slightly different reason.
If I could, I'd like to briefly counterpoint that.
Okay.
If you'll remember, when they went into the nursery and they found out there were super babies, his first reaction was revulsion and potentially even, like, let's destroy these things until he decided he could use one as a weapon.
I forgot about that. Okay, so that makes sense. But it's still, like you said, just something about that didn't feel organic on a whole host of different levels. And the fact that she drove all the way back out there to tell him that she's not going, and then he just kind of lets her go. I mean, just everything about it was just, it was very strange and awkward, and it didn't feel real. So there was that. My favorite part is about the character that I love to hate in the show, and it's Homelander. When he outed Maeve,
yes,
that was, I mean, it was sadistic. It was wrong. He's outing a human being that has not outed herself. That's wrong. He's smiling and pretending he's helping her while twisting the knife because he wants to hurt her. I mean, just everything about it, it added to the level of revulsion and, like, visceral anger I have at this character, and I love it. He is despicable. He is the guy I love to hate on the show. And then there's a girl I love to hate as well, who is Stormlander.
We're going to be referring to Stormlander a few episodes from now.
Their relationship name is Stormlander. You know, yeah. So you have, like, but yes.
He's going to be upset he didn't get top billing.
Yeah, Stormfront, you know. So the two of them are the characters you love to hate in this show. You know, Stormfront is quickly catching up to Homelander, but Homelander is still well in the lead. And so this scene was a perfect, and just another perfect example. I'm just like, I'm watching it, and like DT was talking about before, where, you know, in the past with the Umbrella Academy, where it's like, yes, with Five, when I saw him do this to Maeve, I was like, you dick. You know, so it was like, that is just my visceral reaction. I was like, oh my God, you did it. Oh, you did. You know, so it's just very, very good.
Yeah. Before we jump to Steve, just to talk about that moment. just to, first of all, be outed, whatever you're doing in your personal life. If you wanted to bring it forward, you would. But for someone else to do that in a forced kind of way, and like you said, with the sadistic nature of it, and then to be out on national TV,
yeah,
and you know, have to smile and take it and have your whole life changed for you as someone tortures you and holds the life of your loved one in the balance. I mean, just it was really intense. Go ahead, Steve. Best and worst.
Okay, I think you covered a lot of the really best ones. I think everything good with this episode is either revolves around either Homelander or Stormfront. You guys mentioned almost all the really good Homelander things, although I will say that Homelander firing A-Train from the Seven was another really interesting moment from him. But I'll focus on Stormfront a little bit more since we didn't really talk about her. And that is the revelation that Stormfront was, in fact, the hero that they were looking for. Mother's Milk and Huey and Starlight were looking for. And it turns out that she turns out to be Stormfront. And that really, I thought, was a great revelation. We actually see her killing the brother of this woman who was a child at the time. And it's just, you know, absolutely brutal act of murder. And but the other thing, reason I really liked it is because it kind of shows, OK, if she this was in the 1970s that she did this and she was the same age, you know, that she is now. And it kind of makes me wonder, how old is she? Like, is she since they are really showing, you know, how much of a racist she is and all of this. I'm kind of wondering if she was actually a Nazi, like actually a member of the Nazi party. And if that's the case, that would make her really, really interesting because we see that she has this habit of reinventing herself, you know, for modern times, you know, and of course, which is what an immortal would do. You know, you live forever. You know, what you're going to do is you're going to, you know, change your name. You're going to change your identity to try to fit in the times you're coming from, you know, just so you can survive. But now she's doing it in the way that celebrities reinvent themselves. And that's just a really interesting metaphor. And I like the way that they played that. As for the worst, I think you guys went into the Butcher and Becca stuff enough. Although I will say that I actually did like Becca calling Butcher out on his nonsense, even if it wasn't necessarily executed the right way. I really felt sorry for her, honestly, that she's caught between these two people that in their own ways are equally horrible, and she has to protect her kid in that situation. It just wasn't executed the best way, but I did like that they did that. And the worst, I would say, yeah, definitely the Deep. They were clearly aiming for when Harry met Sally type of situation, like with the jump cuts with the girls doing their little interviews. It made me think of the ones that were interspersed with when Harry met Sally, and that might have been what they were aiming for. But it was just so stupid what it led up to, completely pointless. This character has nothing to add anymore. Why are they doing this whole rehabilitation thing? It's not funny. It's not interesting. Just let this character go.
Yeah, they really messed up when they kind of made him the pervert, if you will, or the beta pervert, because Homelander's a pervert too, but he gets away with it. But the Deep never was going to, but I was like, when they did that, once you do that, you can't really come back from that. And I'm like, are we supposed to be emotionally invested in the Deep in any way? Because I can't figure it out. Like every week, I'm like, don't care, don't care, don't care. Now, if you had given him a true Aquaman moment last episode for more than 5 seconds where he really saved the day or made a difference, then maybe. But I'm like, no. Anyway, one thing I do want to point out is that who Stormfront is, if you haven't read the comics, has been in front of us this whole time because only one side of her head is shaved.
The right side.
That's right. So if you don't know what that means, look that up. But the reason I bring that up is because in reading other reviews and other reactions to this episode, but generally to the character, because there was a lot of pushback on social media when she first shows up. I was stunned, and maybe it was naive on my part. I was stunned to read that some people thought she was a good person or a redeeming character or whatever. They thought she was going to be the one that made the difference. I was like, are you kidding me?
Not on this show.
Right, right. But some people really kind of had the hope that she was the Shining Knight character. I was like, no, she's not.
I know we're all writers here and all that, but like, man, I thought it was so obvious.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like I said, I was really kind of stunned. I was like, you guys are really mad because you thought she was good and she's being corrupted? Like, no. When she came on the scene, upstaging.
Mm-hmm.
Upstaging. That was her first appearance, and she did it with sarcasm. And she, as we were talking about during the break, she slid the knife between his ribs. And whenever you have somebody that's smiling while they stab you, that's not a friendly. Just putting it out there for the cheap seats. So, but anyway, another relationship I'm a little bit tired of is Frenchie and Kimiko. The reason being is because it's kind of going in a circle. And I thought it was interesting that he jumped to hang out with his side chick, but she's kind of a therapeutic side chick or whatever. But I'm like, Kimiko is much more interesting when she's being the Wolverine-esque character that she's supposed to be. I mean, all of her scenes are always brutal and intense. But I'm like, you know, having Frenchie just be hung up on her is, once again, it's just kind of played out. But anyway, so let's talk about a little, let's do a little bit more of a deep dive into Homelander's whole relationship with Doppelganger. We mentioned it, but I want to talk about it in a little bit more detail. And then we're going to move on to the other big reveal. First of all, it was creepy beyond my ability to describe. And second of all, there towards the end, then he's, you know, having the confrontation with himself. And, you know, it was just like, holy cow. So I want to know your thoughts in terms of what did we learn? Because, you know, we keep agreeing that he's the one to watch, that he's definitely the one that makes the show. But what did you think about diving into, you know, even more depths of what is it, self-obsession or a need for coddling? As the, you know, the child god, or as the raging narcissist, you know. So just give me your thoughts about that whole thing about the reveal that's, you know, the Stillwell clone was Doppelganger and turning into himself at the end. And because all those sequences just completely freaked me out. You know what I mean? I wouldn't want to be getting busy with, you know, and then it's me and no. What's wrong with you? So tell me your thoughts on that, Star Wars Nemesis.
Yeah, that is, it's just creepy on a whole host of different levels. I just, everything about it creeped me out. The fact that, and I'm going to go a little bit different place. You know, I know a lot of us are going to focus on how creepy Homelander is, but I'm going to go to Doppelganger. I mean, just the idea, you know, in fantasy and D&D and stuff like that, Doppelgangers always creep me out because of what they could do. And then I recently played a game, Witcher 3, where they took that a different level with doppelgangers, and that freaked me out. And then I see this, you know, just this idea that they could be anybody, that they could do this. I mean, the whole concept of actual gender fluidity here, you know, because they could be whoever they want. What is that, you know, where does that put your brain? Because you could have any genitalia you want at any time. You could probably put it anywhere you want. You could do all these different things. I mean, it's just such an alien concept that it really freaked me out. And watching the interaction between this mentally deranged person and then Doppelganger, who it almost seems like he has no true idea of what his identity or self is. He'll just be whatever he needs to be. These two different ideas clashing against each other and then interacting was so just visually and emotionally disturbing. I can't even begin to explain it.
And then also the thing about that is with everything that's going on around them, and that's kind of his place of refuge, and he mm-hmm. still needs that connection. Then the question then becomes, he's a ticking time bomb now, basically. And then also I was thinking, is it like Mystique and Chameleon Boy from the Legion, where you take their form but you're not really that on the inside, or are you actually transforming? Because that's not quite the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so that's always a thing I think about with shapeshifters. Isn't it an illusion? Is it a surface thing? Is it like your molecules, like the T-1000, just form something else? Or did you really, through and through, transform into that person? Because that's a little bit different. Because how would you know how their soul works? That's a whole nother level. Okay, go ahead, Steve.
Okay. I think we're going to get back a little bit to the idea that Homelander is essentially the Billy Mumy character from the Twilight Zone, where anybody he doesn't like, he just wishes into the cornfield. And, you know, he's this godlike character, basically with the mind of a child. And with it, and there's still a lot of that. So when you take that into account, this is even creepier. And it's creepy on every level. But ultimately, what you have to take away from this is one of the most, you know, derangedly Freudian things I have ever seen on TV. Honestly, you know, it's like he's having this shapeshifter turn into his mother figure, who he murdered, by the way. And you kind of wonder how much, you know, weird, you know, emotions he has, he's dealing with that he's asking the shapeshifter, you know, to replace his mother figure that he murdered. And, you know, and also, you know, the doppelganger character as Madeline is, you know, doing the whole thing with the milk, you know, which is even creepier when you even add that into it. So it's all of this is this, and then he ends up killing, her as himself later, which adds a whole number of weird Freudian psychological things I don't even want to get into. But I will add to that, as far as him killing him, I think what prompted kind of the change was the confrontation he had with Stormfront. And I think what he took away from it was, okay, if I'm going to be loved the way I want to be loved, you know, I have to go and take care of my business. And I think and so we're starting to see that with the way that he's killing the doppelganger, but also like the way he just is systematically going up to each one of these people. You know, he's threatening Starlight. You know, he fires A-Train. You know, he outs Maeve. I mean, just these, you know, things that he's doing. He's deliberately now trying to be kind of even more of a bastard than he already is. And we're talking about a guy who was never stable to begin with, which gets even worse. I will also add, as far as him killing Doppelganger, I think Doppelganger made a huge mistake in turning into Homelander, because it kind of reminded me of a line from a Doctor Who episode called Time Heist, which also dealt with a shapeshifter. And what the shapeshifter says is, how can you trust someone who looks at you from your own eyes? And that is exactly what happened here. He's looking at someone who's looking at him with his own eyes, and he automatically knows that this guy, you know, has been lying to him the entire time. All of this that he's been showing him, even if it was like voluntary, it's still, you know, and I think it is a symbolic rejection of the Homelander that he was, killing him. And so all of this is this weird Freudian psychological stuff. It's fascinating. But it is creepy as all get out. I mean, just absolutely creepy and disgusting. But, you know, you can't, but always with Homelander, it's this mixture of creepy and depraved versus fascinating, because you can't take your eyes off of the guy because he's so entertaining. And that definitely was his whole arc, I think, with this whole episode.
I don't know if it's going to happen. But and don't spoil it if it's from the comics, but I want to see an arc where he loses his powers. Holy cow, if he loses his powers, that man is not going to know what to do. And that's going to be comic gold. Go ahead, Bracey.
I'm going to start talking about Doppelganger in this scene first. Because I really wish he hadn't died, because Doppelganger just got really, really interesting with this particular scene. Now, I suspected when we first saw Stillwell in the little log cabin, all sexied up, that it was probably going to be Doppelganger. That Homelander he's having a bit of buyer's remorse from having killed her. And he still needs her. He still needs people. Until he talks to Stormfront. And then he decides he's basically going to clean house. As you notice, in between the two scenes, he's very ready to go into Doppelganger's embrace in the first scene. And when he returns to him, he's just, like, very much rebuffing him. Like yourself, I wonder about how Doppelganger's powers work a little bit. Is he just an intuitive master of studying other people and understanding? Because his whole deal is infiltration and spycraft and coercion through that. So, and I get the feeling that he was, once his powers developed, he was taken very early on and probably trained in all this from a very early age. So he might have lost whatever identity he might have had from a very early age on, because he's very fluidly accepting of being, it's hard to say if it's really homosexual, if you can turn completely into a woman or not, but he's very okay with being with any sex whatsoever. Or being any sex himself, and even doing it in a completely homosexual sort of manner, as he tried to entreat Homelander with the visage of his own self. It makes it very fascinating. It brings up the whole question of secondary powers. Does he have like some limited telepathy? Can he get a read on you like that? Is it something about becoming your exact biology that you start to think exactly like that person? Really fascinating, and it's a shame that he's dead now, because now I want to know more about Doppelganger.
Yeah.
But Homelander's response, as we've all said, like getting into the whole Freudianness of it, I think you guys really hit it on the head. This is a rejection of who he used to be and how he used to do things, and it was a huge misstep on Doppelganger's part to take his image, because I think it's my supposition that before his talk with Stormfront, before he had this epiphany, he might have actually gone for it, because he's all about like talking about like, you know, humanity as ants and sheep and mud people and all this. Who is more worthy of Homelander than Homelander himself? Because he can never find satisfaction with anybody else. But there can't be two Homelanders, can there? No, mm-hmm. Not the way things are now. So. He is going to be the one true Homelander, the one who doesn't need anybody, including a doppelganger of himself. Really, really fascinating scene. And that's why this was my favorite scene out of the whole show.
Well, people like Homelander, the last person they ever want to face is themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you said it was basically a death move, whether you understood that or not, because Homelander will never face himself. People like him, they never do. It's somebody else's fault. The world isn't treating me right. You people need to change. I'm going to throw a tantrum. I'm going to destroy you. Why aren't you acting the way I saw it in my mind? You know, you never, never look in the mirror. So as soon as he did that, besides being creeped out, I was like, okay, well, you're gone now.
Yeah, he's the abusive husband. He's like, why did you make me do this?
Right. Complete narcissist. I mean, that's the thing. And I think the doppelganger overplayed appealing to his narcissism and it backfired.
Yep.
How could you not hate yourself if you're looking at a mirror version of yourself and you were just getting busy with it? You knew, my God, no. Okay, moving on to a slightly less creepy scene. Let's talk about the reveal of Stormfront as Liberty. I thought that was incredible. It opens up so many questions and so many storylines. But also the way Jaleesa, I forget her real name, I think it's Dawn Nelson, but the way Jaleesa was from a different world, the way she was playing it, she was terrified. And then we see the flashback. And we see, again, just more of the depths of Stormfront's racism. Because I keep wanting to call her Stormlander. Thanks, Nemesis. So it's like we see that this character is very much another version of Homelander, in that she's sold out for her view on the world. She doesn't care who she hurts, and she is a judge, jury, and executioner, just like Homelander. And the black woman character, I forgot her name, has been terrified since she was a little girl. And then you see the shot of the face caved in of the black man that Liberty kills. And it was just, it was brutal.
It was brutal.
Yeah. It really was. And so what did you think about that whole thing? Finding out that reveal, how old must she be? You know, it adds such a new depth and layer to her. And so just give me your reaction to that whole scene. Start with Steve.
Yeah, I already talked about this. I probably blew my load earlier, but I don't mind. I will say that I really do think, as far as Stormfront is concerned, I get the feeling that she's a lot older than even the 1970s. My feeling is she probably was actually a member of the Nazi Party. She might have been a Nazi experiment that was brought over to the U.S. after the war. You know, maybe she was actually a child born then, and they were raised by Vought, and this is what happened. Any number of things is possible, but it's clear that, you know, she doesn't age, she doesn't die, and she's been reinventing herself constantly since that point. And I have to find that really, really is interesting, you know, partly because of the metaphor of the celebrity reinventing themselves. You know, when things go bad, they just change their persona and become somebody else. And that's who Stormfront is. She may not even the only real Stormfront that I can see is someone who absolutely hates anybody who doesn't look like her. And she's repugnant. She may even be more evil than Homelander, honestly. And that is saying something, given how awful Homelander has been just this episode alone. And she's arguably even more vicious than him. So all these people talking about, oh, well, you know, she might be the good person in the seven. I think she may, in fact, be the worst, both because of her beliefs, which are repugnant, and the fact that she is clearly a sadist who gets off on murdering, minority people. Like, you know, she's a serial killer, essentially, and she's getting her rocks off doing this, and she's using the guise of being a hero to cover up her murderous acts. She's absolutely a disgusting character, and the more we find out about her, the more horrible and fascinating she becomes, the same way that Homelander is. And I have to say, this is what The Boys really does best. You know, these complex characters that are horrible, but because they're so horrible, you can't take your eyes away from them. And I think that's definitely true of Stormfront, even though we saw very little of her beyond the whole fight with Homelander. I mean, just finding out who she was, it just adds a whole new layer to her. And I thought that was really great.
Go ahead, Bracey.
Okay, having the advantage of having read a majority of the comics, I'm going to echo Steve's thought, because I think that's tying in there. In the comics, Stormfront is indeed a Nazi Superman. Straight up Nazi. So with the revelation that she doesn't appear to age, I fully expect it to be revealed that she has been around since the 40s, that she was indeed a Nazi experiment. And that's likely where Compound V came from. And Vought, I'm pretty sure, is a German root for a name, for a surname. So it all fits together rather nicely, because we know when the Allies won the war, we grabbed up a lot of scientific secrets and scientists. So why not grab up some Nazi superheroes while we're at it and learn how to reverse engineer this stuff so we can put it to use for ourselves? Makes perfect sense within the context of the show and the timeline. So, yeah, that's going to be quite the interesting revelation, and especially with, like, you know, little things that once you put that together, you start cluing in. Stormfront, a lot of Nazi operations were named after storms. You know, there was the lightning war, the Blitzkrieg. The lightning was a very important symbol. What does Stormfront wield? She wields lightning. She likes to wear an outfit that looks like black leather, like the SS. She's got the shaved side of her head, very indicative of the neo-Nazi movement in America. Lots of things that are tying together into this whole identity. And it makes a perverse amount of sense that not only would she and the government at the time, if they capture her away from the Nazi program, was like, you know, you've got to do something for us. They would reinvent her as Liberty, you know, this all-American symbol. That's the only way she can get by. I think it's deliciously exciting, and at the same time, I did not see this twist coming, so bravo. That was very exciting for me to see.
The only way she could get by, that is perfectly said, because I thought about a Highlander. You have to disappear every 70 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the best place to disappear into when you've got superpowers? A superhero, but you're really a murderer. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Okay, I am going to take a slightly different take on this one. The actual reveal with Stormfront and the fact that she is a racist and that she's obviously has an extended life, you know, and all that, I thought that was very, very well done. I enjoyed it very much. I did not see the reveal that she was Liberty coming. I always enjoy it when I'm surprised by something like that. So all of that was good. What I will say is that, and just shortly here, because I'm going to save most of my anger for a later episode, since I'm current on the episodes right now, is that I think that this whole idea of, and I'm going to go on a little soapbox here, revisionist history about Operation Paperclip and what those scientists were like and what they brought and stuff like that, it, to me, really bothers me, and because pop culture has such a far reach and influences people's minds, they believe that the pop culture fiction of Operation Paperclip is the reality of Operation Paperclip. Two completely different things. And as somebody who is a historian studied history, I'm not a historian, and has been in the military and all these other things, it just, that really bugs me to no end. And then the constant focus on Nazis, and specifically Nazis of the German variety, I'm just like, go somewhere else, you know, in my mind. Do something else. And the fact that this particular story reminds me, and I don't know when the Boys comic books came out versus these movies, but it reminds me so much of the stuff from Captain America Winter Soldier and Hydra, and them infiltrating and being part of S.H.I.E.L.D. and everything, that to me, you could almost fold Stormfront right into that and it would be seamless, you know? So from a comic book standpoint, from a history standpoint and everything, I'm like, there are so many other repugnant groups throughout history that I think you could do something with them, even if you wanted to do something with fascism. You know, you really want to get into a different level of fascism, bring someone forward that was Italian, you know, from under Mussolini. Or go into some of the Austrian or even Hungarian fascists who are fascinating. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff you could do there. And so it really bugs me. And stuff that's going to come up in later episodes bugs me even more, to the point of making me actually angry.
Oh, yeah. They're definitely the easiest villains to hate, if you will. And definitely the quickest and most commonly used targets. But don't even get me started on the Rwandan Civil War. If we brought some people out of that, and if we talked about that, and they were talking about if they were going to race flip Magneto to be a survivor of that war.
Right.
And what would happen if we actually introduced America to the idea that all black people aren't the same, and that Africa is not a country. It's a continent with many countries.
And I would very much encourage, you know, people, go out and read about Operation Paperclip, because it's true. I mean, it's not our finest hour. We did bring some people who were actual Nazis over here. That is absolutely true. But not all of them were, and not all of them had the type of influence and a bunch of other things that people like to pretend they did. It's a piece of history that's worth reading about.
I was merely speaking of in the context of the show
I'm not you.
I didn't think you were digging at me like that. I think DT has it right on the head there. It's like, why the Nazis? Because it's always the easiest. It's one enemy we can always agree on.
Yeah, well, I want to see some characters where we help people understand that Ghana is not the same as Kenya, not the same as South Africa, not the same as Ivory Coast, not the same as Egypt. These are different people. Okay, and that label black people, we just slap a label on people that have different languages, dialects, flags, diets, religious beliefs, polytheistic versus monotheistic, just so many different things, different points of liberty. So,
you can expand that into, I mean, you know, I don't want to go too deep into a bunch of different examples, but just in recent history, from two different cultures, in Africa, you had Idi Amin, and in Cambodia, you had Pol Pot. You know, so, I mean, those are two horrific human beings that hardly ever get talked about. So,
all right, we're going to have to call it there. But as you can see, lots of interesting conversation and just a brief nod to the writer's code. It's the kind of stuff we like to see, stuff that makes you think, stuff that makes you hungry for more, stuff that makes you feel the human emotion of what the characters are going through, even in a sci-fi or fantasy setting, when the emotions and the experiences are real, things that make you want to learn more about actual history, as Emerson said, versus commonly thought history or misconceived history, and just so much. And see, that's what good writing does. It makes you grow as a person. It challenges your perception of the world. And so far, The Boys is really doing that on a variety of levels. So I want to thank our audience. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Sloppy Spoilers. I want to thank my co-host. Thank you so much, Bracey.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. My pleasure as always.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Remember, we didn't start the fire. It was always burning since the world's been turning.
Thank you so much, Nemesis.
Yeah, I want to say to everybody, I was made for loving you, baby. So
don't forget to follow us on Twitter and throw us your comments. We really want to hear your feedback on the episodes and our commentary. We definitely love to talk to you on social media. So hit us up. Thanks again for listening. And we will see you the next time on the next episode of Sloppy Spoilers.